walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is John Shirva, who covers horse racing for the Los Angeles Times. Shirva has been covering sports for more than four decades, including nine straight Olympics, much of that period with the Times, but also involving a stint as sports editor of the Chicago Tribune. Shirva's been on the horse racing beat for a number of years and was the reporter who broke the story about the disturbing string of deaths at the Santa Anita racetrack, which now stands at 23 horses. He was at Saturday's Kentucky Derby, of course, and in an interview recorded yesterday, we discussed the historic outcome of that race and the debate over the stewards' decision. In the context of the deaths at Santa Anita, reforms the racing industry is considering making, proposed federal legislation, and more. I'll play back that interview with John Shirva in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the show, I'll talk with Patrick Rose, executive director of the Save the Manatee Club, who will tell us about this Saturday's Save the Manatee 5K, an annual fundraiser held in Lake St. Clair, Michigan, but virtual participants can register and run, walk, bike, or swim from anywhere in the world, and then the proceeds from that go to the Save the Manatee Club back here in Florida. It all takes a circuitous route, but we'll hear all about that, and again, it helps manatees. Did I mention that? Lastly, I think it's important to mention that our summer fun drive is just around the corner, so if you like the work we do here on Talking Animals, whether it's shows like today's exploration of horse racing and manatees, last week's local spotlight on the gigantic adoption event taking place at the Hernando County Fairgrounds on May 17th through 19th, and the local, at least to me, photographer Lori Wolf, plus recent interviews with Franz DeWall, Temple Grandin, and so on, please drop a few bucks in the Talking Animals tip jar. Go to WMNF.org, find Talking Animals on the broadcast schedule, Wednesday at 10 a.m., I hasten to add. Click on that and you should see our tip jar near the top. Any donation of any size you can make today will be much appreciated and give us a little bit of a head start on our fundraising goal for that time, and always hugely important to chip away at that before the actual fund drive day. So thanks for any support you can offer. Right now, let's hear my interview with John Shirva, recorded yesterday. This is LA Times horse racing writer John Shirva on Talking Animals on WMNF. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals, John.
Oh, you bet. Glad to be here.
So you were obviously at the Kentucky Derby Saturday. Describe what that was like even before the race, given the growing concerns and scrutiny that have resulted, chiefly from the string of deaths at Santa Anita. And we'll circle back to that maybe a little bit later and more specifically, but just seems like a key moment in time in horse racing.
Well, this was a very, very critical weekend for horse racing. I mean, the one thing they could not have is to have a horse go down in the Kentucky Derby. Now, it's only happened once, and I think that was in 2008 when eight bells went down after the finish line. But it's kind of remarkable in 145 years that only one horse has suffered a catastrophic injury and had to be euthanized. So, but everyone knew the stakes were really high. We had your typical Derby week, which was, intermittent rain, and you knew it was going to rain on Saturday because it just seems to do it all the time, although the actual percentages are like around 40%. You had sort of a group of non-superstar horses. You had a lot of horses that were a little bit under the radar. We're coming off a Triple Crown year with Justify, which everyone was focused on. So there was a lot of evenly matched horses. Bob Baffert was telling me that this is probably the most evenly matched field in, 15, 20 years. So that was the backdrop that this Derby was run.
And again, as you noted, it typically does rain, and then it hadn't rained, near as I could tell, all that much, at least in the key kind of time leading up to the race, except for about 15, 20 minutes directly before the race, and then it really did rain hard. So what did the track look like at that point to you right before the race began?
Well, the track was listed as sloppy, and what that means is basically your designations are fast, good, or wet fast, sloppy, and muddy. And sloppy happens when they seal the track. And by sealing the track, that means that they basically compress the dirt so that the water doesn't penetrate into the dirt. Because if the water penetrates into the dirt, then the designation becomes muddy. So it actually started raining maybe about 2 hours before the race, but not heavily. Just enough to get everybody to pull the ponchos out. And the track seemed to be holding water pretty well. And I don't really think the surface was that bad. But the thing that, of course, we all had to remember was when you go back to Santa Anita, one of the prime culprits, they believe, although they've never really been able to confirm, was the fact that horses had been running on sealed tracks for like 31 times, or at least it was sealed 31 times. Although generally what people think that means is it's like if you're running on a pool table, something very hard and flat, is that you could develop some micro fractures that are really kind of undetectable and could show up in a couple of races. So, you know, but just the word sealed track, and I'm not one on predictions, but I predict that in California, you probably will not see sealed tracks anymore once they get, you know, once we get past this this period that they're going through now.
That was something I, of course, was going to ask you about at some point, but this might be as good a moment at least to address that. So it sounds like you're thinking that because it seems like, although no one's made this official regarding the deaths at Santa Anita, that the sealed track was probably the chief culprit that what would be a reform or somehow outlawed at Santa Anita and elsewhere, that you could no longer have sealed track?
Yeah, there were some days that they should have canceled racing and they didn't. And again, I think if you look at the damage that a sealed track can do, and I'll also say they've been running on sealed tracks for years and years. Why it suddenly showed up this year, I don't know, but we had like 20 inches of rain. So
yeah,
that was a problem. But also, I think what was going on there is California is an island and it has a smaller horse population. And by an island, I mean, it's not like they can, you know, ship in horses. Like if in New York, you can bring in horses from Pennsylvania, you know, from Maryland. If you're in Maryland, you can bring them in. You know, everything is a lot closer so that horses can move in and out very quickly. Now, one thing that was going on, according to the trainers, is that management at Santa Anita was kind of pressuring them to run their horses more frequently or to run them in races that they thought they could run. And Santa Anita, Tim Ritvo, the COO of Stronach Group, denied that, although he did say he encouraged trainers to not scratch if they had a bad post position. Now, why that's important is you want full fields. And by full fields, you want 8 or 9 or 10 horses, 7, 8, 9 horses. You don't want to be running with 5 or 6. Why? Because there are more betting opportunities with fuller field. More betting opportunities means bigger handle. Bigger handle means the track makes more money and everybody makes money. So there's that that's going on. And this is based on the trainers. And then the other thing that I think was totally, I don't want to say unintentional, but it in the back of your mind, and if you don't mind me to go sort of off topic here for a second.
Sure.
I was sports editor of the Chicago Tribune when we owned the Chicago Cub. And at no point during my 7 years there was I ever told to not write something bad about the Cub or really do anything that was unjournalistic. However, in the back of my mind, I knew that we owned the Chicago Cubs. And so if I had negative stories about the Cubs, I would bring them to the attention of the managing editor before I ran them. And she was always great. And we ran them and there was no problem. But that was in the back of my mind. And the reason I bring up that analogy is you've got veterinarians who are, you know, just terrific people and do God's work. But, you know, they're examining horses and they're looking at the fact that there's 6 and 5 horse fields that you don't want to become 5 and 4 horse fields. And so I just wonder in the back of their mind, you know, were they was their sliding bar on what was an acceptable position to let a horse run, or do you, you know, scratch him at the gate? So I think there was some of that going on, mm-hmm. and I'm not pointing fingers or saying any one particular one, but it's just sort of the same culture that I was aware of when I was in Chicago, that they were aware of, that, you know, for this sport to survive and be really good, we need, you know, we need fuller fields and we need more horses running.
Right. So I guess to take one step further, what you're saying is, like, for those veterinarians, unless there's a really compelling reason to keep horse A out of this particular race, probably shouldn't do it.
Yeah. I mean, I just think, I mean, that's sort of the simplest way to put it. I think it's much more incremental than that.
Sure. Yeah. But much more subtle, I'm sure, than that. But it sounds like... Yeah, I mean, to the layperson, I mean, not surprisingly, I guess, just because the kind of money that's at stake in various ways is tremendous. But one thing I was going to get into with you later, but this seems to tie directly in, is back to the Derby for a sec. Much has been made, at least in certain quarters, about the questions about safety of a 20-horse field. And before you even get into whatever kind of track conditions, weather, et cetera, there might be. So, and again, notoriously, now there's the question about what's motivating, in this case, Churchill Downs, to allow a 20-horse field if it's not indeed as safe maybe as it could be. On the other hand, I know that kind of field is not uncommon and hasn't been, I guess, for years, certainly at Churchill Downs. But to what extent does that tie into some of the same observations you were just sharing?
Well, the Derby is the only race in the United States that has a 20-horse field. Most fields are capped at 14, and that is a safety issue. Gary West earlier this week talked about Churchill Downs greed, and for running 20 horses. Well, I'll try to be as agnostic on this as I can, but getting a horse in the Kentucky Derby is a big deal, and it's what everybody starts with. You know, I think it's like less than one hundredth of a percent of horses that are actually born can make it to the Kentucky Derby, and to make it, to get it there is just a, you know, this huge deal. And you know, the fields used to be smaller, but you know, it's a pretty big track, it's a pretty wide home stretch, so they just increased it and they added an auxiliary gate, and then you've got 20 horses in there. And yes, I think a 6-horse field is safer than a 10-horse field, which is safer than a 14, which is safer than a 20. And that's not any genius on my part. That's just common sense, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, Gary West has a point. But on the other hand, they're trying to reward as many owners as they possibly can. And, of course, they're going to make more money that way, too. But, you know, it's just the Kentucky Derby is so big. It's so large. So people who don't care about horse racing just get together for derby parties. I mean, it's part of the American fabric. And then next week when we're at the Preakness, you know, you'll see, and frankly, I prefer covering the Preakness because it's smaller, it's more manageable, it's easier. You know, interest will just drop off. I mean, it'll be half or a third, you know, of what it is during the Kentucky Derby, especially this year when there's absolutely no chance of Triple Crown.
Yeah, well, it seems like the Triple Crown not being a possibility. And also, it just seems, I guess, kind of in a way you're indirectly noting this, I mean, there's just such pageantry and all kinds of other related things that seem to surround the Kentucky Derby. So it just seems like maybe there's fanciful hats and other things at the Preakness, for example, or some counterpart to Mint Julep. But it just seems like that accounts, at least in part, for the much greater interest just to people who, as you say, may not otherwise pay much attention to horse racing the rest of the year, but that's their day, for better or worse.
Yeah, so. I mean, the Preakness, they put on a good party, but you know, for example, in Louisville, I'm staying about 9 or 10 miles away from the track in what would be, you know, nicely called a flea bag hotel, which is, you know, a 2 or 3 star. And for those last three nights, I'm paying $375 a night. Nobody gouges. I was talking to some other sports journalists, and we all voted that the number one gouge city when you cover something is the Kentucky Derby, is Louisville. A good example is the place, one of the big places people like to stay is the Galt House, and that's downtown. It's a very nice hotel. That is $1,100 a night.
Oh, my God.
Now, last November, they held the Breeders' Cup at Churchill Downs, and I stayed at the Golf House for $220 a night. So, you know, that's a bit of
markup there.
Bit of a markup, and it's still horse racing, but it's not the Derby.
Yeah, it's just, I guess it's just really kind of its own singular thing in many, many ways, good and maybe not so good. But so speaking of that, let's get back to Saturday. So it rained, the track's sloppy. Now, when you're covering something like the Kentucky Derby, are you talking to people right up to the moment the horses are led to the gate, or what are you doing at those final moments?
Well, it's unaffectionately referred to as the longest day in sports. I get there to the track about 8, and the race isn't until 6:30.
Yeah.
And during the day you can chat with trainers or people, but there's really no point in it because you're not really going to write anything. You can gather color, you can gather stuff like that, but mm-hmm. basically you're going to write what happened and that. So what you do is, I can get them in the paddock before the race, but I traditionally don't because you can't even get near there. I mean, it's like 20 deep around there. And just for me to fish my way through there. And then the paddock is just jammed with people. Although at the Preakness, I'll talk to the trainers in the paddock, but just at the Derby's, you don't. And then you, generally just go in a tunnel, an area near the track, near the winner's circle. And you are watching it on TV, essentially. You're watching it on the big video boards because, you know, you can't really see all the way around the track. Mm. You go there and you watch it on video boards. And then as soon as the race is over, you know, all the jocks come off the horses. The trainers come, you know, all go to their horses. That's your chance to interview the losers, essentially. And in this case, you know, we were talking to people and John Service was going to be the winning trainer. So, you know, you're going to get him and the jockey in the press room. Well, guess what happens? You know, the objection sign comes up and I honestly didn't think that the horse would come down because no other horse had come down in 144 years. And but then the longer it goes, and then when you're at like the 10-minute mark, you're thinking, oh, this could change. And we're watching, you know, we're trying to find a TV somewhere, you know, that you can look at the replays. But that first day, that Saturday, I did not think the horse should come down. But on Sunday, I completely changed my mind when I saw some other pictures, some other angles, and that's sort of how it went.
Well, I want to come back to that in more detail. Let me just first let folks know this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with John Sherva, who covers horse racing for the Los Angeles Times. This interview was recorded yesterday. So back to race day. How quickly did you become aware that there might have been a foul in the race? I mean, it just seemed like...
It was a couple minutes,
yeah.
You know, because basically there was the jubilation, you know, the West came down from their box. And people are in the winner's circle. And as a matter of fact, I think Mary West might have even had a bouquet of roses in her arm that they had to sort of take from her. But it was a couple minutes because the system is the jockeys can lodge an objection on the track, you know, basically on the horse. It's unclear whether Flavien Prat or John Court issued the first objection, but they both did, and then they have to go and they talk to the stewards. I mean, that's, you know, objections are not uncommon. I mean, they happen all the time. But what was puzzling is that the stewards didn't put up an inquiry sign. And an inquiry is of a higher level. That's like the stewards are saying, yes, we think we need to look at this. A jockey's objection says, well, we're going to listen to hear what the jockeys say. And the fact they never put the inquiry sign, I think, was a mistake that they made. And actually, when I was talking to Mark Cassie on Sunday morning, and he had War of Will, he said, you know, they made the right call, but that's where they screwed up, is they didn't post the inquiry sign.
So when the stewards were reviewing the videotapes for those 22 minutes, I mean, what was that like? That seems like, by most accounts, a long, long time. Were people, like, anxious, antsy, nutso? What, while people were awaiting that decision, as all those minutes ticked by, what was it like there on the ground?
Well, the first 10 minutes was pretty much pro forma. Okay, you know, they lobbed an objection. No one really thought anything would happen. And I don't know. I mean, you could help me on this. How NBC was, how they were painting that picture at that time. Whether they painted it as something, oh, this could be real, or no, this is nothing. I don't know, because we weren't watching the NBC feed.
Yeah.
So it was sort of casual for the first part. And I mean, I've been in the winner's circle dozens and dozens of times while you've waited out photos, while you've waited out inquiries, or you've waited out objections, and you don't really think about it until it starts to drag on. And then when you're at the 10-minute mark, you're thinking, whoa, boy. And then you're at the 12-minute mark, and then the 15, and then the panic starts to set in somewhere between like 12 and 15 minutes. Like, oh my goodness, they may be changing the result. And obviously, to use two words that people often misuse, the people that were on top were anxious, and the people who could move up were eager.
Yeah.
That's sort of how it went. And then when they flash it and change the order, it's sort of pandemonium. There's an immediate shock and dismay and all those kind of words for the maximum security people, and the country house people are like, oh my God, we just backed into the Kentucky Derby. And Bill Mott has never won a Derby. Flavian Pratt, who's very young, and never won a Derby. The ownership group never won a Derby. None of them really want to. You don't really want to back into a Derby.
Yeah.
But you're going to take it.
Right.
You're not going to
right.
take it. No. That's okay. That's not going to happen.
Yeah. So the singularity of those 22 minutes sort of ticking by slowly, 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 and I'm sure the tension mounting, might have only been exceeded by the moment the steward's decision was announced, or it's something even more singular.
Yeah, and also too, I don't bet, but there were a lot of people who had a lot of money on maximum security, and again, I hate to go back to neighborhood derby parties, but hopefully there's someone in that derby party can explain to all the lay people what went down, because that doesn't help the sport when something like that happens, even though I think in hindsight it was absolutely the right call. Because it's, how do you explain that?
Yeah.
Because in real time, I don't know anybody that could see anything in real time.
And among those truly knowledgeable about horse racing and the nuances of its rules, the initial uproar seemed to give way to pretty much a consensus that the steward's decision had been correct. And one of the things you wrote afterwards frankly acknowledged that you changed your mind, I guess, from one day to the next on whether the steward's decision was correct or not. How so? How did you yourself arrive at kind of a different place on this?
That night, I was Saturday night, I was looking at replays, and to be honest with you, I had a story for the front page. I mean, the story suddenly got so big they wanted it on the front page of the LA Times, the sports section. I also had to do another story for the sports section, and then I had to do a almost daily newsletter on horse racing too. So I didn't have a lot of time to study. I was just sort of talking to some of the people around me, and what you had was history on your side. Like, they'd never done this before, and they're going to do this one on one that you can't really tell. Well, the next morning I was out with at the barns at 7, and I was talking to Sid McGahee and Bill Mott and Mark Cassie. And then also someone, showed me this picture of the back leg of Maximum Security being in the middle of the two front legs of War of Will.
Yeah.
Now, Cassie just started, he basically said, he says, I don't feel sorry for myself. I'm just glad I have that horse, because they came perilously close to that horse going down.
Yeah.
And if that horse goes down, there's a bunch of horses in back of them. They're going to go down too. And it's not an exaggeration to say that you might have had 3 or 4 dead horses and goodness knows severely injured or worse jockey from that situation, if War of Will was not such a superior athlete and Tyler Gaffione didn't do such a great job on him to keep him from going down. And that, I think, would have been the moment that when they write the history of horse racing, would have been the moment that horse racing officially went on the critical and endangered list and may have actually ended it. Because when you have an incident like that on national TV with the highest rating since 1990 on NBC, and you combine that with the 23 horse deaths in California at Santa Anita, and all the optics that go around the sport, dying horses, whipping horses, things like that, I don't know if the sport recovers.
Well, along those lines, John, I mean, almost sort of in a cynical reverse engineering of the decision, at least on Saturday, again, as a layperson, when that decision was announced, this before there was images or footage showing what you just described about how almost sort of entwined, really, those horses' legs were and how close it came to a complete disaster. I couldn't help thinking that part of this, at least Stewart's decision, was being mindful of what all had happened at Santa Anita and saying, hey, yeah, this is unprecedented, but given everything that's gone on, this is the decision we must make. Did anybody talk about that, or did that figure in any way that anybody would even acknowledge?
If you read between the lines, I think people, and the stewards have been virtually silent. They read a 120-word statement that didn't really tell us anything more than we didn't know before. But, you know, Santa Anita, the specter of that remains over the sport and will remain over the sport. And it's not like this is the first time this has happened. In New York, at Aqueduct, they had this was 20 or so years ago, they had a lot of breakdowns, and they actually closed down the track for a little while, and that led to major reform in New York racing. They had a similar situation in Saratoga a few years ago, you know, or maybe 10 years ago, a lot of breakdowns, and they figured out it was a track, they fixed it, and they moved on. Del Mar had a situation just a few years ago, maybe 5 years ago, with both their turf and dirt courses. They were having breakdowns. They shut down the turf course. And in both cases, it was new surfaces that were installed. In Santa Anita's case, it was not a new surface. It was an old surface, although there was a new track superintendent. And that's why no one could quite figure this out. But I think if you look toward, and I don't know if you get into this much in your show, but people's perception of animals has changed, I think, in the last 10 to 20 years, that people are really much more concerned. And I'm not talking about, you know, speciesism or whatever it's pronounced. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about people caring more for their animals.
Yeah.
Now, I've got a 10-pound rescue that a dog that is not my equal, but I would risk my own life to save his. Mm. And I don't know if that makes sense or not.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of your listeners probably would do the same thing.
For sure.
And I think that's how we feel about our animals today. You know, and it's different than where you are. California's, I'd like to call, a rather progressive state. When things happen, they're on top of it. Let's say Kentucky, the thoroughbred industry is so into the culture of there, and horses dying is part of that culture, that I'm not sure they say, oh, okay, you know, that's just part of horse racing. Well, this time in California, they're saying this shouldn't be part of horse racing. And Tim Sullivan, a columnist for the Louisville Courier-Journal, was able to get some statistics that Churchill Downs was the second most had the second worst fatality rate of any track in America, behind Hawthorne in Illinois or in Chicago. And Santa Anita was actually down the list, but of course that was like last year's figures. And you know, again, people's feelings about animals has just evolved, and it's just changed. And I think that's playing into what's going on here, too.
Yeah, well, I want to kind of connect those dots a little bit. Just quickly again say this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with John Sherba, a special contributor to the Los Angeles Times, who covers horse racing for the paper. This interview was recorded yesterday. So, yeah, given that sort of growing concern for animals that you've noted, I just think there's been sort of a parallel growing concern about horse racing, even before Santa Anita or Saturday or anything else. And hey, there we go. There's our first talking animals for the moment. So, yeah, you mentioned the dog, and the dog says, I've got my own things to say on the matter. But so I think there's a lot more concern, a lot more maybe objection to the sport. I think especially something like the Kentucky Derby, when these are very young horses, I think people are worried that, like, these young horses on those very tiny, relatively speaking, legs, and then you add the 20-horse field and all kinds of things that, as you say, it came very close to sort of a cataclysmic day, but there's often just a recipe for disaster there. I mean, you've been covering sports for 40-plus years more, including several Olympics and other major events, so you're probably attuned to instances where a sport is experiencing a significant transition. Is that where we are with horse racing?
Yes, this is very much a transition phase. Part of the thing is you look at the audience. It's very old. It's very male. It's very white. And while I fit that demographic too, we're all dying off, you know? And horse racing has this real need to attract younger audience. I mean, if it wasn't for casino gambling and slot machines and things like that, horse racing would be in a whole lot more trouble. But a lot of it is subsidized by the term is called a racino, which is a racing casino, where money from the slots help pay for purses. Gulfstream in Florida, I know some of your audience might get down to South Florida, and then is one of those. Tampa Bay Downs is not. It's a traditional racetrack, that's sort of what's been propping up the industry. But it's an industry that the demos are not good. The demos are very old. I mean, it's kind of the demo of the people that read newspapers. I subscribe to a newspaper, but I still tend to read it online, either on my laptop or my phone.
Mm-hmm.
And the paper product is sort of sits there where my wife does the jumble on the on that. So, yes, very much a sport in transition, a sport that, what is its future? I don't know. I mean, I think if we get out of this Santa Anita thing and Del Mar does well and the rest of the year goes without incident, I think we'll be okay.
Hmm.
And by we, I don't mean like I'm part of the industry. I covered the industry, but that's just sort of the way it is. And here's the thing to think about. People will ask me, do I think horse racing should be abolished or whatever? And I never answer the question, but answer the question with a question. And this is something your audience can ponder. Is it better to have been born and run the risk that at a young age that you may suffer a catastrophic injury that will, you know, end your life before its time? Or is it better to have never been born at all? Because that's really what we've got here. These horses would not be alive. They would not be running on pastures and frolicking and playing and all that stuff. No, they would not exist. And if thoroughbred racing did not exist, I fully expect within a couple generations that breed would be extinct, because there's no really other reason for it. So that's kind of the question to ponder. And I think when you know the answer to that question, you know your opinion about horse racing.
Well, it is a significant, chewy, and sort of disturbing question to ponder, but I see the importance of it, too, in terms of how you're answering their question with that question. And again, it does seem back to the thing that you noted about people being more and more concerned about animals, that it is sort of a polarizing world. Again, you've got, as you say, the constituencies that's aging out, maybe, or fading out, but still very vocal and passionate now. I'm curious, given how polarizing it is, does being on the horse racing beat mean at any given moment, you know, absorbing angry comments, at least online or whatever, from both pro racing folks and those vehemently opposed to it?
Oh, I, like you said, I've been doing this a very long time, and I've never run into such a bitter audience. And I think part of that is because it's tied into racing. Now, I'm going to also say that's a very small minority of it, and there's so many wonderful, great people that email me with thanks and all this stuff all the time. But, you know, during these past 3 months, I would say that my email, which is considerable, I probably get on horse racing, I probably get 30 to 50 emails a day. Which is a lot.
Yeah.
I was the first one to write about the breakdowns at Santa Anita. They knew it was going on, but they weren't saying anything. And I just started running the stats and checking the stewards' reports and the stewards' minutes. And then when Battle of Midway, a Breeders' Cup winner, went down on a Saturday, I says, and I was actually working on the story. I was going to report it for the following week, do some more reporting. I says, I got to write this. I got to write it now. And as soon as frankly, the LA Times reported about all these breakdowns at Santa Anita, it became a national story.
Yeah.
And a national story very quick. And that next Monday, there were five TV cameras, lined up barn where they work out the horses. So I get it's, I'd say it runs about 2 to 1 people telling me that I'm trying, that I'm the reason that California racing may die and that I'm killing California racing. And then I also get a lot of email from the animal rights people saying, you know, you're promoting the slaughter of horses.
Well,
so
that's,
you know, you're a journalist and you know that I guess a compliment is when both sides hate you.
Right. Well, yeah, but it does seem the more I've thought about stuff and sort of did research, because even before things kind of went the way they did on Saturday, I just felt like this was a key moment to have this kind of conversation in the wake of the Kentucky Derby with someone like yourself. In preparation for that, and reading a bunch of stuff and by different beat writers, especially and others, I mean, it just was struck as a side note, but still interesting that a certain story could inspire comments equally on both sides. Somebody would write something that said, hey, here's the concern, or here's kind of where we're at a bad moment, or here's what's happened in Santa Anita. And then the comments would be attacking people from both sides being steamed about it. And I thought, well, geez, this is hard to reconcile. But I guess it's just, again, part of the volatile, polarizing nature of the horse racing world.
Yeah, and again, you know, horse racing exists because of gambling, and that can color your perception. It's why I don't bet. And when I say I don't bet, that's a slight fib in the fact that, you know, again, you get to the track at for workouts in the morning, and then you're there all day. I'll occasionally, like, if some of our local handicappers. I'll bet $2 across to $2 to win, place, and show on a horse just to pass the time. And of course, I never bet on a race that I would actually cover, because I think that would be sort of unethical.
Yeah.
But I'm not considered by any way, shape, or form a bettor, because I don't want anything to color my view of a race. Let's face it, the journalism is hard enough.
Sure.
Okay. I need to want to be handicapping, too? I don't think so.
Well, John, we're sort of nearing the end of our time, but anything you want to add just as we do reach the end here of our conversation about any sort of reforms that are either being put in place or being considered, or even the, I guess there's national legislation that's pending that maybe we should address?
Well, there's the Horse Racing Integrity Act, which is mostly about having a national body oversee the sport. It is, there are three big groups that run racing. One is the Stronach Group, which owns Santa Anita, Golden Gate, Laurel, Gulfstream. There is NYRA, which is the New York Racing Association, which owns all the New York track. And then there's CDI, or Churchill Downs Incorporated, which has Churchill Downs, Arlington, Fairgrounds. And then there are a bunch of sort of independent tracks like Del Mar and Tampa Bay, you know, that are out there too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even here, the Stronach Group and the New York Group are in favor of the Horse Racing Integrity Act. Churchill Downs is not in favor of it because they don't think it should be federally legislated. And,
yeah.
And these three groups really don't work well together at all. And I've often said that if horse racing were to die, that the death certificate, the cause of death, would be suicide, because they're all really into their own interest, and at this time, more than any, they need to get together and work together for the common good. But, you know, what also is in the background, not to get too much into the weeds, they all have their own ADWs, or advanced deposit wagering, as does TVG, which is the fourth one, but they don't own any tracks. And it's all about, you know, simulcast wagering money. You know, these organizations, they do love the horses. And I will say, without question, that the most of the trainers and the jockeys and the grooms and all the backstretch people, they just love those horses. And those horses are better cared for than if they were on a farm. I mean, they get daily vet checks, they, you know, but they are asked, you know, daily they gallop, and maybe once in every week they may work out, timed workout, and maybe once a month they run, and that's what we think they like to do. That's what they're bred for. It's like almost like a family business. If your parents were in, let's say, the bakery business or a car dealership or something like that, and there's a good chance the kid will be doing the same thing. Well, that's sort of how the horses are bred. You know, they're to do this, to run, and there's danger involved. So. I don't know, I kind of went in like 6 different directions there, so I apologize, but
No, but it's just, I think that's a measure of what all is going on at the moment and just the different sort of fissures within the racing industry and how everybody kind of has their own little fiefdoms, it seems, and is not interested in being any more of a unified body than that. So, interesting. Yeah. Well, John, we have reached the end of our time, but thank you very much. We've been speaking with John Sherva, who covers, again, horse racing for the Los Angeles Times and a number of other things, too. And so, of course, gear up and for the Preakness, the next part of the Triple Crown, if you want to follow what happens next in this, what sounds like, again, pivotal sort of transitional moment. So I guess we'll follow closely what happens, again, as the population that really follows it closely does age out. And as you say, there may be some self-inflicted wounds in the industry that also maybe bring about its decline, at least, if not demise. So, John, thank you very much for joining us today on Talking Animals. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Oh, certainly my pleasure.
Thank you.
All right, my thanks again to John Sherva for making the time to speak with us about the current state of horse racing and where it may be heading. In a few moments, I'll speak with Patrick Rose of Save the Manatee Club. There's a 5K race this Saturday, technically held in Michigan, but anyone anywhere can participate virtually. And the proceeds, no matter where they're participating, help manatees. So we'll hear all about that in a moment or two. Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner. This is Kevin Nealon chatting with Conan O'Brien on Conan's show just a few nights ago in a piece I'm calling Salmon in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
You look sharp. You look good. You look like you're taking care of business.
I am taking care of business.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot. My father used to say that a lot. I get dressed, he goes, "You're looking really smart. That's a smart shirt."
Yeah.
You know, you're looking really smart.
But also, you look like you look healthy. You look like you're taking care of yourself.
Thank you for that nice compliment. Because compliments from you are very rare, and I will take that one.
I don't think that's true. I think I'm quite generous with a compliment, but I do
well,
think you're
let
looking...
Well, let me just...
Okay.
Because I don't believe any of that, but
all
let
right.
me just address what you had said
yeah,
earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a vegetarian, mostly.
Yeah.
On occasion, I will have fish.
On occasion, yeah.
But I'm one of those people, it's got to be a specific fish. It's got to be salmon.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It has to be wild salmon.
Wild salmon.
And it has to be caught in the big river in Montana. And it has to be bear caught.
A bear has to catch it.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's got to be bear caught. And in his mouth, not with a fishing pole.
That's just dumb.
And then, wait, let me finish.
Oh, there's more.
I call it bear to table fish.
All right, very nice. I like that you're looking after yourself, though. I care about you. You're
and
a friend of mine.
I care about you, too. And by the way, you're looking fantastic.
I'm glad.
This is your crowd tonight.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, finally.
Yeah.
That was Kevin Nealon with a piece I've called Salmon, taken from his appearance just a few nights ago on Conan. Now it's time to speak with Patrick Rose, the executive director of the Save the Manatee Club, who will tell us about this innovative 5K run taking place this Saturday and more. Here's Patrick Rose on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. And why don't we jump in by just, first of all, maybe giving us a brief overview of Save the Manatee. When was it founded and what's its mission?
Yes, Save the Manatee Club was founded in 1981. It was sparked by Jimmy Buffett and Governor Bob Graham, who later became our Florida senator, getting together and seeing what they could do to help protect manatees. And this is, of course, about 37 years to going on 38 years later, and there's still a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, not coincidentally, I think any of us that pay even passing attention to manatees know how vulnerable they are to, it seems like, so many factors that can injure or worse manatees. How would you say they're doing at the moment collectively?
Well, if you take the long history of when they were first listed as an endangered species, then their numbers were quite low due to hunting pressures from directly being killed to how many we have today, it's a positive story because we have more manatees today substantially than we had then. However, when you look at what's happening right now, we just came off of the worst year ever for watercraft injury and deaths for manatees in 2018.
Mm.
We're actually now about 40% above that record for 2019. We lost over 800 manatees, so we while we came a long ways, the problems both directly on the water as well as their habitat issues are accelerating. And so it'd be hard for people to hear about Florida and not hear about the algal blooms, red tides, and other pollution problems with Lake Okeechobee and those discharges. So they're struggling.
Is it things like the algae and stuff that largely contribute to the fluctuations of how they're doing in any given period?
Well, in terms of the long term, it's one of the most serious things. We have their greatest mortality risk is watercraft, both through injury and death. However, in order to be able to sustain those losses to the population, you have to have a healthy ecosystem. And now that we're getting sort of that double whammy of them being killed directly, as well as their habitat suffering substantial seagrass losses, and you hear about the fish kills and those kinds of things. So it isn't, of course, just the manatees ecosystems that are suffering, but those for all of our aquatic species. And if we don't get a handle on that, you're going to lose not only manatees, but many other species. And, of course, humans are going to suffer ultimately as well.
Of course. And what measures specifically does the Save the Manatee Club undertake to help the manatees, and especially with some of these multiple factors you just described, working hard against their survival? What kind of steps does the club take to offset those?
Well, some of the most immediate ones that probably people do hear about are we work with a partnership to rescue, rehabilitate, and return to the wild those manatees that have been sick or injured.
Mm-hmm.
We support the state and federal programs that are in place to help protect manatees. We oftentimes support them directly, but many other times we're having to say, yeah, you're doing a lot, but there's a lot more that must be done. So we work through the education process. We work with schools and teachers. We also do a lot of work with the Florida legislature and, of course, the United States Congress. And right now we're facing some severe challenges both to the Marine Mammal Protection Act as well as the Endangered Species Act. So we're having to engage and advocate for the manatees and other imperiled species' best interest. We are involved in research where we study not only the manatees but their habitat and help to fight for preserving the laws we have, but also strengthening them as needed, because I think it would be hard to argue that our current laws are strong enough to protect those ecosystems. We're hopeful our new governor is going to continue on with his promises to do better, but we've had quite a few years under a past administration where we've just seen our protections for our aquatic ecosystems going backwards. So we reach out and form partnerships with many in the communities as well as industry and try to make that world a safer place. And we look at ourselves as the voice for manatees since 1981, but there's still a lot, again, more to do.
Yeah, and boy, the array of things you just described, say the Manatee Club does do or seek to do. I'm curious, what are the sources of funding? I mean, I know you're a 501c3. I mean, do you have grants? Is it strictly donations? How else are you? Because a lot of those things you described, I would assume, take considerable resources to do and do effectively.
Well, they do. We don't hire any fundraising, Don. We do it with our members and supporters. Our manatee adoption program is our primary source of revenue, where someone can adopt a real living manatee. They don't get to take it home, but
yeah,
it is a real manatee with its own history and background. And those start at $25 and go a little bit up from there with other things thrown in, if you will. Educators can adopt for $20. We have a few grants, but we take no state or federal money. In fact, we're the ones behind Save the Manatee license plate. We got it done, but we actually had the money coming from the license plates go to the state of Florida in order to help with those state programs. So we do depend solely on contributions and support. Certainly we welcome grant support, but most of our money comes in through the adoption program or through outright gifts.
I got you. Well, this may bring us to what it seems like, I assume at least, is another source of some size, which is the big 5K, Save the Manatee 5K, happening this Saturday. Tell us a little bit about that and its history and kind of how it's become both Michigan-based and sort of worldwide in a sense at the same time.
Well, yeah, we're really excited. This is going to be the sixth 16th year in a row that the Save the Manatee 5K is going to be held at Lake St. Clair Metro Park in Michigan. And there's a biology school teacher named Leslie Argyri who began that back in 2003 and has worked with her husband and in a crew of volunteers from Leanne's Cruz High School to put on that 5K race. It's grown year after year. In 2015, we added an element to it to have a virtual participants. And in fact, this year we have over 1,200 virtual participants, as well as more than 800 actual participants there in Michigan for this Saturday's race on May 11th. And we still encourage people can still actually sign up for that. But it does show the appeal and people's understanding of how unique manatees are and how much, in fact, they do need our help. They're a species that, while they're a large marine mammal, can weigh, 2,000, 3,000 pounds. They're probably the most docile animal in the world. They just don't have the ability to be aggressive. And we, as men, are their problem, and we need to work with our strong supporters like Leslie and others, no matter where they live, to help support manatees where they are in the world.
Yeah, I mean, really, who doesn't love manatees? I mean, I got to believe the anti-manatee faction is quite small. But so tell us, Patrick, and we just have another moment or so at the most left here, but tell us how people hearing this could still sign up to participate virtually, because again, they could be anywhere. They're listening primarily in Florida, but if they're listening online and they could be anywhere, my understanding is that then they can participate in the Save the Manatee 5K and in fact doing almost any activity that they choose.
That's right. They could swim, they could walk, they could skip their way through. They're still signing up for participants, so if you're in that Michigan area, the Lake St. Clair area, you could still sign up and actually participate. They can go to SaveTheManatee5K.com, which is a special site for signing up for the race this Saturday. At this moment, we have limited the virtual, I hate to say this, because we want to make sure everyone who is participating gets their medal and gets their T-shirt and in their other issues. The virtual will likely be open back up soon, but we would encourage people to go to that website or to our website at SaveTheManatee.org, and they can also participate there through just contributions. They could also let people know they want to do it on behalf of the race as well. Again, thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. We are working, of course, very vigorously in Florida and throughout the Southeast, but we also have programs to help manatees in West Africa, South America as well.
Great. All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that, and folks can check out Save the Manatee 5K, and maybe there'll be a little window that opens up to participate, but that's great that you have that kind of number, both virtual and actual participants already. So good for you, and thanks, Patrick, for joining us today on Talk Animals, and good luck not only with Saturday's event, but beyond in terms of your efforts to help our manatee friends.
Well, thank you, Duncan. And if people just want to learn more about manatees and how they can help, they just go to SaveTheManatee.org. We'll be more than happy to share with them. And again, thank you for your opportunity today.
Absolutely. Thank you again. Take care.
All right. Take care.
All right, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Coming up immediately after the NPR News headlines, of course, will be Rob Lori with Radioactivity, extending this four-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour, Midpoint with Noah LeLay. Then at 1 p.m. is John Gilmore's NPR News headlines, WMNF Tampa.